Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
So good morning, everybody, and welcome to the fourth episode of a series of four on the topic differential diagnosis in muscular dystrophies. Today, we are going to talk about phenotype heterogeneity in muscular dystrophies. And I'm very happy to have with me Professor John Wissing. He's a professor of neurology at the University of Copenhagen, Denmark, and director of the Copenhagen Neuromuscular Centers at the Rigshospitalet in Copenhagen. He has wide research interests and expertise in hereditary muscle diseases, metabolic myopathies, myasthenia. And I'm happy that he agreed to join this podcast. So, John, welcome. I think we can just start discussing some of the aspects that probably are relevant for phenotype heterogeneity. I was thinking about the neuromuscular examination. It has some special aspects in comparison to general neurological examination. So, if you could highlight the not to miss things that we should look at.
Sure, Frederik, and thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. Before the examination, obviously, you have the medical history, which is also really important. There's the family history, episodes of rhabdo, and so on. I think something that we often miss is to talk about, you know, how was it when you were in school? For instance, how did you perform in gym classes? And people ask a little bit too superficially about this in my point of view. And patients also answer sometimes, you know, very defensive, because for them it was normal that they didn't do so much. So they say it's normal. So you really, really have to probe into this, I think. But on the examination, if you have a muscular dystrophy, obviously the first key thing is, what is really the pattern of muscle affection? Where is the patient actually affected? Where is their muscle weakness? Where do we see atrophy of the muscle or hypertrophy, which is sometimes, you know, also an interesting finding. Contractures, some of the muscle diseases are prone to very heavy contractors, like in Bethlem myopathy, certain of the congenital myopathies. But most muscular dystrophies have contractors to some extent anyway. Could it be, for instance, just a short Achilles tendon, which is also interesting. Then there's, besides the whole muscle thing, is of course also some of the extramuscular manifestations and the especially cognition, which is a part of the neurological exam, which is certainly interesting for a number of these muscular dystrophies. But it's really a question of pattern recognition, I would say, first and foremost in the exam.
Yes, exactly. And then I was thinking also of some signs that we should actually look for. So, for example, some, you know, facial signs, or just even look for, you know, myotonia, if we think at myotonic dystrophies, or if we think at the tongue, if we are thinking in some other muscular dystrophies. So, you know, to keep in mind for a general neurologist that we could extend the neurological examination looking for some storytelling signs that maybe can be clarifying for the diagnosis. So
yeah,
definitely.
And certainly. And myotonia obviously is a real giveaway, because then you have really nailed things down there. And obviously in the non-dystrophic myotonias, myotonia is extremely severe in most cases, whereas in myotonic dystrophy type 1 and 2, it's much milder. Even in type 2s, you may even miss it on the clinical exam.
Exactly. And the other thing I was thinking is, you know, we especially you, of course, but me too, at the beginning, we paid very much attention to these clinical signs and medical history, and we tried to have a clinical suspect as specific as possible and then guide the genetic diagnosis. And now, you know, we have these very powerful genetic tools that we can use very soon. The question is, what's the point to have a very specific diagnosis if we then go straight forward for our next generation sequencing techniques and then we have the diagnosis?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I remember when all these genetic techniques came up, and I thought, you know, now maybe I can retire. It has actually proven the other way around, I think. Actually, your expertise has to be even better. And it gets better because you learn a lot from getting all these findings, because they're not perfect. The geneticist may call a gene and it may be wrong. And you are the person who should, you know, discard a genetic diagnosis when it has been made, when it's wrong. So I think it's actually, for me, it has been a wonderful experience, because I thought my, you know, learning curve had sort of flattened out a little bit, but it was very steep during you know, the time of next generation sequencing, because it has really taught me a lot. It has also taught us that, you know, patients that have a completely different phenotype that we would not associate with the disease could also have this phenotype. So this is really also what next generation sequencing has taught us. But then again, you know, there are many errors and variants of unknown significance that we need to take into account. And so I think it's a wonderful instrument. And obviously, if we look into the future, this will be more and more and more refined, and it will give us less and less error. So I think down the road in 10 years, maybe 20 years, we could come to a situation where you could almost just do your genetic test. But where we are today, it's still a little bit the Wild West, and you really have to be a marvelous neurologist to stand against the tsunami of genetic results, you know, and prove them or disprove them.
You have to be also very convincing toward the geneticist in some cases. Okay, well, and probably also some paraclinical examinations help in clarifying these unclear mutations or uncertain mutations. So you are, of course, an expert also on muscle MRI, and nowadays also muscle ultrasound is coming up. So what do you think is the role of these examinations in the differential diagnosis of muscular dystrophies?
Yeah, and I also, you know, muscle biopsy. We used to use this as sort of the first tier test, and now we're doing next generation sequencing. But then a lot of the muscle biopsies we're doing, we're actually doing them to verify the genetic test. So muscle biopsy is still around, but it has sort of a different role. And for the imaging, I think this is an extremely interesting field. Because really, one thing is our pattern recognition when we look at the patient, but that can be very difficult. With an MRI machine, you can look into the patient and meticulously look at it, every single muscle, how it is affected. And for most of these, we have learned, you know, from all the MR examinations that have been done, that these, some of these diseases actually have a signature. And we have had already the very beginning of artificial intelligence programs where we have taught machines 10 different diseases. And then, you know, we experts have been reviewing many scans, and then the machine did it, and the machine actually beats the expert. And I think for most cases, unless you are sort of in a complete end stage of the disease, you can actually diagnose all muscle diseases with MRI, because they do have a signature. It's almost close to 100% that you can get the diagnosis just from reading a scan. So I think with the automated segmentations that are coming up, which makes it a lot easier, and with the whole body scans, so you get the signature for all muscles, we will in the future be able to post a diagnosis very correctly with MRI.
So do you think, of course, there is a certain overlap between some muscular dystrophies and the muscle MRI's signature, if we want to call it like that. So which are the muscular diseases you would identify as really very specific from the MRI point of view, especially specific in a way? So
All of them. I think, you know, you are absolutely right that many of the diseases can look alike. But if you scan all muscles, some of the muscles are different among all these diseases. So you will be able to get a correct diagnosis in all the patients, unless you are close to not affected, or, you know, at the two ends of the spectrum, of course, it can be a problem. But if you are symptomatic somewhere in there in the middle, MRI will be able to tell you the diagnosis. Ultrasound is also a helpful technique, as it's also on the rise. Obviously, it cannot do the same thing as MRI. You can't read as deep down in the muscle. So there are some muscle groups you cannot, you know, image with ultrasound. You cannot make a whole body ultrasound examination either. Getting a diagnosis on ultrasound is, you can't do that. But you can use ultrasound for other things, and now there are more quantitative ways of looking at ultrasound, so you can actually also follow patients. And obviously, it is extremely handy to have in the clinic because it's just right there by next to you, and you can reach out and look at the muscle. For instance, before you do a muscle biopsy, there it's very helpful to guide you.
Thank you. And of course, I know you are a fan of MRI. I was thinking maybe you can add what's the best time point to have it. So you were talking about at the time of diagnosis or at the time of a suspect, and then we use it mostly into clinical trials or even for monitoring patients, sometime also in the follow-up, even though in some cases, you know, we get the feedback also for patients, yes, but I mean, the progression is visible, so why are we going to do an MRI again? So what's your opinion about that?
We don't typically do MRI follow-ups just, you know, in a clinical setting as such, but we do a lot of trials, so we are, in fact, doing it anyway in quite a number of them. We do use MRI typically on at diagnosis, to see exactly what is affected, what can we expect, is it compatible with the disease and the genotype of the patient, and so on. And then if we have patients that are on expensive treatments, we like Pompe disease, we do use it as an outcome measure. And it has proven, you know, very reliable and strong endpoint for follow-up even, but also to assess effects on treatment.
And also you were talking about the different involvement of different muscles, of course, in the different muscular diseases. In some cases, I find it very interesting the reason why some muscles are affected in some muscle diseases and not in others, even though, you know, protein expression is similar maybe between different muscular groups. So do we have any, you know, molecular insights into this differential expression among different muscular dystrophies?
Well, I mean, we have more than 300 muscles in the body, and they all look like beef, basically, when you look at them. But they are not, you know, they are individual organs. And although you are right, there is similarities among, you know, protein expression, what should be noted is that there are differences as well. They are different. They do express proteins differently. They do have, you know, different insertions Some are pennate and some are straight, and you know, some have a fiber type composition, which is different from another one. The innervation is slightly different. The motor units are bigger in one muscle than in another muscle. So certainly this is part of it, definitely. Making the muscle more susceptible if it has a kind of a setup, if it has an defect on the cell surface, or whether it has a structural protein in it. I think this is the explanation. Nobody can really tell because nobody really knows. But I think this is at the very heart of explaining why we have such differences in affection for proximal distal muscles. And then there are some more erratic muscle or more unpredictable, like in FSHD, where you know you have very asymmetric affection, and that is strange because you would think the muscles on the other side would have exactly the same composition of proteins and so on. And but I think for some diseases there are probably, it's a question of triggers that you need, that there needs to be a trigger. And we don't know exactly, for instance, in FSHD, what it is that triggers the DUX4 expression all of a sudden in a muscle. If you test the FSHD patients, you can see that DUX4 is actually silent, but then in diseased muscles, the expression is turned on. And that's probably some external trigger. It could be an inflammatory response, like we also see in rheumatological diseases. Well, all of a sudden you get an Achilles tendonitis on one side, but not the other one. Why? You know, it's probably the same picture.
Yes, that's what makes interesting in a way our job, and also when we counsel patients that have exactly the same disease or even gene mutation, to predict in a way what's gonna be there, the phenotype, in an accurate way. So it's sometimes very, very challenging. And well, you have already discussed a bit of new AI applications and deep learning. What do you think is the situation now? Are we there yet in using them a bit for the differential diagnosis? And what's your prediction for the future in a way? So when are we going to use them? How? Of course, it's a very broad question, but you know, the first studies on, for example, face recognition are being underway, and you've discussed about MRI imaging. So what's your opinion about that?
I think there will be a huge development in this field, and probably, you know, there will not only, if we look at single areas, for instance, artificial intelligence in reading MRIs, is there's a lot of work ongoing there. And I think in very few years, this will probably be something that you can just pull down from the internet and use. But I think more importantly is that we will probably have many of these initiatives where you can pool things together and get a clear picture. The same for next generation sequencing. I mean, one of the limitations today is not the sequencing. It used to be sequencing, which was the problem in the past. Now that's no problem. Now it's reading all the data we get. And I think artificial intelligence will also there play a big role. And then then there's the question of all the wearables that patients can have, all the apps that are being developed for the different diseases that can feed in data to the doctor from the patient. And this is also on the way. And this can also be integrated in our platforms at the hospital and help, you know, if we follow up a patient. These can be endpoints, for instance, for treatment decisions or in a clinical trial. It's going to be a huge development, the way I see it. Or reading biopsies, you know, reading muscle biopsies and so on. Also there will be artificial intelligence. It's quite primitive and people have worked on it a long time, but it's like the technology is much better now. And I think there will also be breakthroughs in this front in the coming years,
Yes, and of course, this goes in parallel with data sharing. So we need to have the instruments that we can rely on so that the machine then can also analyze all these data. So if we are able to put them together in a way. Is there anything? Yeah.
A very important point, because for instance, in teaching machines to read MRIs, and if we want them to be able to know every single disease, some of the diseases are so rare, so no single center would never be able to, you know, teach a computer how a POTBC3 patient looks like, because we only have zero or three patients. And so we need to work together to do this.
Exactly. Do you think there is anything else on the topic that we have forgotten that is really important still to discuss?
No, I think, you know, some of the, definitely some of the extramuscular manifestations are also becoming clearer, because I think for some cases we have focused a lot on this is a muscle disease. It's obviously has been obvious for a long time for patients with myotonic dystrophy that this is a multi-system disease where you have to look in a lot of places. And obviously, it has been also known for many years that the heart can be affected in many of these conditions. And I think mostly, you know, there's a good setup for this in most places, so we don't have to work so much on that. But I think, you know, looking at other organ systems, it's not been noticed so much. Take Pompe disease, for instance. It was, if we go back 10 years, nobody thought about, you know, other organ affections in this disease. But in fact, there are quite a number of organ affections. And another thing I think we have maybe neglected a little bit is the brain involvement in some of the muscle diseases besides DM1, which has, you know, always been known. So, for instance, in dystrophinopathies, certainly there is some, and it has been studied to some extent in Duchenne, but hardly at all in Becker muscular dystrophy, although there certainly is some cognitive problems there. The same goes with, you know, a lot of the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, is particularly those that affect the alpha-dystroglycans. So I think this should also be a focus.
Yes, definitely. And this, we will add this focus together with the other ones that we have discussed during this interview. So there is definitely a lot to do in the field. And I hope that we could raise the interest of the audience on this topic that definitely needs more neurologists. And I thank you very much for joining the Today podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.